Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson.
And I'm Maureen Smith.
And we are joined today by Dan Grambau.
Hello.
Head of Floating Opera Company?
Yeah, General Director.
General Director. I figured, because you've got away with titles and such, and so I was like, I'm sure he's got one right now. Like, yeah, I was like, I should make sure, yeah.
I mean, you could say Artistic Director.
Right.
That'll simplify it, yeah.
Cool. Well, yeah, I mean, you've got a ton of projects coming up. We're glad to have you on. We were talking before that I actually, like, before we started recording the podcast, like 2 years ago when I was flirting with starting Scoppy Mag back up again, or starting, I don't remember what point, but I'd actually interviewed you in the past. And so it's cool to actually do it for real and know that this is, you know, going to actually benefit someone, you know, at all. Yeah. Which is
that
cool.
Someone will hear it.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Because I don't even know where that, I did it on like a mic that I had at the time. And I don't even know where it is anymore, but it would be really funny to unearth that at some point. So it was like 2 years ago. I think it was like before Cozy.
It was before the tour and before before all the shenanigans for Giovanni. And,
right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, you've been making opera and working in Chicago for what, like at least 3 years, probably?
So I moved here 4 years ago and started off just singing. So, like, you know, started off as a singer, like did a young artist program, did a couple different things, got away from the pay to sings, which was like, thank God.
Yeah.
And then got into this world of just like, you know, I was getting hired every month in Chicago for a different project. And after about a year and a half, I think I had done like something like 16, 17 different operas and like different roles like throughout the city, and like completely overwhelmed and overworked and not paid enough, and realized that, like, you know, I could probably do this. It's like I could probably create like a company that, you know, pays people at least similar or more.
Yeah.
And try to build from there to get something more substantial.
Right. Or at least not paying to sing a role.
Yeah.
At the bare minimum, which I think is kind of what a lot of people that are making, that are producing, are trying to strive against. Because, you know, because we all know the people that are doing that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, cool. I know the most immediate project you have coming up, or not coming up, but it started and is kind of in process, is the Incubator series.
Yeah, so.
Which is cool. Yeah, do you mind going for it? Yeah, talk about it?
Yeah, there's a guy in Pilsen named Aaron Marsh, who's really cool, a really cool guy. And Pilsen right now is like really like a hotbed of incubators. Like on this one street around like 18th Street, there's like four incubators or something like that. All like around the same area with this like positive energy about like changing the world through art and collaboration.
That sounds like Pilsen.
Yeah. It does, yeah. It's great. But Aaron, like, you know, wanted to get more active with Floating Opera a while ago, and like, you know, he finally reached out to me and he's like, you know, let's do something together. And then we talked about the incubator and I went over and kind of was like, can we host it here?
Right.
And he's like, yeah, sure. And then I invited a bunch of key people that I thought might be interested in creating new work, and we've been meeting once a month, end of the month, the last Thursday of each month, and encouraging people to bring original projects. And we've had things come out of that, like graphic novels, original, like more like heady, like opera where you record people in different rooms. Like, we have like big concept projects about, like, you know, a singing blog, and like we have like all these really cool creators that are all gathered once a month that can work on their own, show up or not show up, but like foster this really energetic environment about, you know, creating new work. Yeah. And I think that, everybody's doing that, but I think that, you know, they're doing it alone, and this is a place where, you know, you don't have to do it alone. You can show people and not be like all over the internet blasting it,
right?
You know,
no, and it sounds to me like it's kind of like something that holds you accountable. Like, there's this once a month thing where you meet with your like a scheduled, you know, it will for sure be the last Thursday of every month. You meet with your collaborators and you say, this is what I've done. Where if you just kind of like, if you don't have that, like, in your calendar, or, like, in your schedule, you know, you could let potential collaborations just kind of winnow away because of scheduling,
right?
Honestly, so.
Yeah, and this has really led to some cool stuff. I mean, like, me and my assistant, Taylor Walters-Chapin, who's, like, super creative and awesome, we're going on a road trip to pursue one of her projects she's working on. So we're going down to Mississippi next week because we've got that positive energy, like, to create this new project.
Cool.
Which is awesome. Like, I mean, like, we're meeting with, like, a chief archaeologist in Mississippi.
Yeah.
That she found that we're going to be basing a project off of. And it's, like, it's really cool seeing that, like, just by hosting something for 2 times, we've only done it twice so far. We're going to do it through the whole year, but 2 times, it's already created enough momentum to get people to drive across the country to create new work.
Well, and there's something that you brought up. We met and talked about this, and one of the initiatives that you're creating through the incubator is this concept of the New 100.
Yeah. So the name of the incubator is the New 100, and that's because the whole purpose of it is we're going to create 100 produced works, meaning after we hit the 100, it could continue, it could not continue, but our intention is to foster, like, whether it's like an original novel, whether it's a screenplay, an animated short, like, you know, whether it's an opera, a play, like a monologue, like something that you will perform and produce like 100 times over. So,
yeah,
that's great. Well, and at one, and you said that at some point you're like, once you kind of like track 100, that you're hoping to like showcase that.
Yeah. So, we want to start getting like festivals going. I mean, like we did talk about a New Works Festival, in the new year, but again, it's more about the fact that I think that we just need to get our feet grounded a little bit before that can even happen.
Yeah.
And right now I think, I've had a lot of conversations with people about these new works that are being written all across the country, like women composers, like all these Opera American grants that are going everywhere. And like, there's a lot of positive energy for new work, but I think that the thing is like, they need to be conversations with people about issues that are important that like can relate to people.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just kind of, you know, writing something by yourself and not sharing it. And then when you finally show it, it might not come out the way that you want it to.
Yeah. I think this actually kind of hits on something that we were talking about recently, which is like the idea of like art not being able to exist in a bubble, or in a vacuum rather, where like you can be like a creative force, but if you're not like looking for different perspectives and like trying to reach out to different influences, although, I mean, of course there are some cases where it can still be like really influential and really effective, but like to some extent, like I know like Nina Simone would always say this, like, as an artist, there is a bit of a responsibility to like kind of recognize the culture and the society that your art is being, that your art is present in, because you can't deny that it has an effect. And I mean, how much you relate to that or not. And so my point with all of that is that I think that, like an incubator series like this clearly is a really strong tool for that. And another thing that we were talking about a lot is the idea of like monthly performances. We were talking about that with Lee Wichman for Cacta.
Yeah.
And just like the challenges and the benefits of doing it. Are there things that, like there were things that he was talking about that, you know, the first few months it was hard to figure out like the, I guess like the checklist or the to-do list, like the things that he knew he would have to do every month, for example. But, well, A, you're coming at it from a different perspective in that you've produced a ton, and B, it's a different animal entirely. Are there things that are difficult and things that are easy with doing this monthly
like format?
I think the biggest thing is like you don't know who to expect is going to show.
Sure.
There are the core people that show every time that like, you know, are basically being poked by me like every single like week.
Yeah.
But I mean, like overall, it's the challenges come down to, is it catching on? Do we need to do more marketing? Is there a way that we can collaborate with other incubators to get more involved? And all those kind of things, like, you know, we've been pursuing. For me, it's like, you know, I've got my own creative projects that, like, you know, I check in probably 2 weeks before each incubator to see where we're at. But it's funny, like, for the last one, like, I was so worried no one would show up. And then we had everybody show up, and we had, like, an original song. We had a script. We had some concept art that just came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, cool. Like, at least something's happening. Like, you know, because the worry is, like, you know, you do this thing and, like, it's not going to catch on or not connect with people. But overall, like, the connection's there. I'm like, I'm seeing it happen.
Yeah.
It just, you know, it requires more time on my behalf to regularly talk with people and be like, are you creating something? Are you doing something? And be kind of like a face of, like, the incubator. You need someone to be that host.
Right.
Yeah.
And the idea would be, if we did reach capacity, which I don't see happening in the next couple months, but if we did get over, like, you know, 50 people at Nightcap, and, you know, because not...
Nightcap is a small space.
It's a small space, yeah. We'd have to grow to other locations, which I'm okay with. And I think that that would be an opportunity to engage with different communities. But for me, it's like, I'm not from Pilsen. I mean, my wife is from, is born and raised in Chicago. She has a lot of opinions about, like, you know, different areas. And, like, you know, she has a lot of, like informed perspective about the art scene. And I think really I need to fully understand the areas I'm in before I can, like, produce something there. Instead of just doing what I like to call, like, drive-by art.
Right.
Which is essentially like, you know, this is my project and you accept it now. Like, you know, instead of engaging with the climate of where you're at. I mean, like, you can rent a space and perform, but if you're not really incorporating the block that you're on.
Why would they come?
Why would they care?
Who's going to show up besides your audience that's in the neighborhood you're from, you know?
Oh, I'm sorry. So I had a question and now I'm going to build on that question. First part of that question is, has organizing this monthly meetup that encourages artists to create, has it encouraged you to create?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. I feel so energized. I mean, like, for me, so since our last performance, which was like Quantum Mechanic, that was our last big thing. We did Redwoods in Chicago, which is basically like a small workshop with Redwoods Opera and Elizabeth Vernios, which was like not really a performance. It was more like a workshop.
Right.
Which is great. Then I got married, and then I just, like, have been creating since the election, like, all the way through 2017.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the composite opera, like, you know, War and Peace came out of that. Also, I wrote a play, which is really awesome, which is all, like, I'm now apparently working with this graphic artist, like, to try to make that into something.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, all these things, like, you're realizing that everybody has their own tool and their own way of expressing themselves. And, like, there's a lot of ways to cross-collaborate across the table with people that, like, are interested in doing that.
Yeah.
Well,
I have an interesting question, because I obviously know, working with you from the Giovanni and kind of that stretch of floating up until it, and so Cozy, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else in there that I was missing. I know you guys did a couple concerts up at
at Lincoln Park.
Indian Boundary?
Oh, Indian Boundary Park, yeah.
Yeah.
We did some 30-minute shows, yeah.
Yeah, right. So that was a pretty busy stretch that you had. And then you guys have been focusing on, like, the workshops and the incubator, which are these kind of, I wouldn't say reflective, but maybe reflective, but also, like, really important and really thoughtful and really smart kind of development. Like, creative development.
And, like, building a base, kind of. Yeah.
Was there a reason for that? Do you think it was just fortunate? Are there things that you're glad for about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, with starting any business, you need to, you know, attract as many eyeballs to your business as possible.
Right.
So, I mean, like, all those eyeballs can see Floating Opera on the internet, like, all those things that exists. We're, like, in the world.
Right.
We're not invisible. Also, like, we've got a lot of partnerships that I've, like, fostered through the tour, through the different productions we've done. And the reason why I kind of hit the ground running was because I think that my big transition kind of came at our first Cozy. So when we did 2014 in the Fine Arts Building. So in 2014, we did a Cozy in Curtis Hall, and I had to drop out of the show from singing the show into producing and directing and, like, filling in for the end of the show. Because everything was kind of, like, falling apart. Like, all these things were going. And I realized that, like, I got such a rush from that, that, like, I just enjoyed producing so much that, like, I just needed to do that. And then I started, like, hitting the ground running for the next year. I was like, I'm going to produce everything. So, like, that's what we did 27 shows later, you know?
Yeah.
I, like, basically was looking back, and I'm like, we've done really good work, but, like, why did we? And also, like, you know, what was the big accomplishment? What were the big takebacks? Like, I needed some time to process all that. And also, we needed to reestablish our board. We needed to do a lot of things, like, within our organization. And I think those are all details that just are super important that arts organizations, like, when they're trying to get started, like, they skip steps.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we skip some too, but at least I'm smart enough to like look back and see that.
Right.
And not completely like get burnt out and give up on what we're doing because it's important.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's really very interesting. Just the idea of this. I don't know, because I remember being during it, like looking at it from like the inside or even as a spectator. And it was just like, oh man, like these performances are what needs to be happening. But then I totally do also understand what you're saying about it just... I can easily picture the thought of looking back afterwards and going like, what have I actually done with this? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, obviously there were some big takeaways. I mean, like, because I did all that, I got to talk to Anthony Freud and Larry mm-hmm. Gobram, like get coffee with him now, which is crazy.
Just but, casual.
Yeah. Well, it was kind of like a once coffee kind of thing, yeah. But mm-hmm. I don't know. He's intelligent guy. Cool thing. Like I got to talk about economics of opera. Which if I wouldn't have done that panel, I wouldn't have been able to do all the research that was needed for that kind of panel. And like, right. You know, I got to really like dig into like what issues there are in like in the economy of the opera world. Mm-hmm. And then it's funny cause like we talked about Peter Sings a little bit, like, yeah. You know, just like that part of what's funding the opera world. There's so many factors that go into that. And then I looked back at my own finances for Floating Opera, and I'm like, we did 27 shows, and we're still in the black. Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't lose money. And why was that? Because we sold tickets. And we, yeah. Like, we stayed above water just by selling tickets. And it's like, talking to Anthony Ford, he's like, yeah, like, 26% of the house is ticket sales. And I'm like, 92% is ticket yeah. sales. And I'm like, there's something about that that should say something about the product.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and I think... developing a good product and something that can sell consistently, like, mm-hmm. needs to be the focus. And I mean, whether that means like stop producing really depressing operas that people don't want to see, that could be the choice. Start doing more comedies, that could be the choice. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like, those are decisions for an artistic director.
Yeah.
And I just realized, like, you know, through all the producing and, you know, designing lights and directing productions and doing all those things, without a true direction and connection to mission, like, you're missing the point, like, yeah. You know, of where the product lies.
Yeah. Well, I have another follow-up question to kind of that thought, too. I think, if you look at just, like, the brass tacks of what you've done and what you're looking to do, I think that in and of itself is interesting. But I also think there's really something to be said about having it happen in Chicago. And, I mean, we don't entirely talk about, like, Chicago as an... I mean, we do a little bit, but we don't really actually get into it. And I think you're afforded such a unique opportunity and, like, perspective. And I have a similar one from Opera on Tap. But, you know, there are a few people that... I mean, there are a ton of people that do this. But there are people that kind of know how wealthy Chicago is in talent, in singing talent especially. Like, there are probably, I mean, what would you say, like, 200 singers... classical singers in Chicago?
So many more. I mean, like...
At least, yeah.
For our last auditions for... I mean, I don't know how many auditions we'll hold in the future, yeah. But it's like... Because it's just overwhelming.
Right.
That process, it's like we saw like 300 applications, mm-hmm. only had scheduled time for 200
yeah.
for a weekend. And by the end of it, it was like, there's just too much talent in the room.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can't hear it all. And you also, like, you're casting a really specific thing. And it's like, I understand why so many people start companies. Because it's like, there's so much talent to speak for the issues and to do all these things. Mm-hmm. The issue I see with all that, though, is it's a saturated market.
Absolutely.
And the impact from this talent is misguided in kind of weird ways. And not mm-hmm. reaching areas that it could reach. I mean, like, for Chicago, like... I work in education.
Yeah.
It's like another thing that I do. Like, you know, and I see the Chicago Public Schools, and I see, you know, I go to a lot of like Ingenuity conferences and stuff to further education in Chicago for kids and music education. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that we took them downtown to like a big cultural institution, and most of the kids had never left their block. Mm. And I think that just says something about, like, you know, how people's perspective is so trapped in where they're at. It's Absolutely. Not really, it's not communicating with each other. You're not, like, you know, you're not really talking. You're just kind of mm-hmm. reacting.
Well, and it kind of gives you a snapshot of what living in Chicago is actually, or like being from Chicago is actually like, because as someone who grew up not in Chicago, my idea of Chicago was downtown. And, you know, I didn't really have a sense of like what it was to actually live here. Whereas, you know, these people who live here, who are from here, who like have roots here, had never been there.
Yeah.
Which gives you, you know, I think it takes like living here and getting out of your comfort zone and like actually meeting people who are not from these specific areas to like really get an idea of what the city needs artistically.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, this is something that I read about in like my economics research or whatever. There's an article in Labor Economics that was all about like the Opera House effect, which was really, really cool. They did a study about like in the 18th century about the Baroque opera houses in Germany that kind of evolved over time. And when roads were built, they saw this trend of people flocking towards the richest, glitziest, most cultured areas of Germany. Which is really, really like fascinating when you think about it, that there's this effect towards cultural institutions. These cultural institutions draw people to cities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what you're talking about. Like you came down from Milwaukee, like basically like being like, oh man, the Lyric, like,
But like, that's such a small fraction of what this city is. And that's what's astounding is like the Lyric is the Lyric. It's this cultural institution. It's this like beacon and it's this like shining example of like high opera. But like, if you talk to 90% of the singers in this city, it's like, oh yeah, no, I've never sung with the Lyric, but I do make a living off of music.
Yeah.
Which is incredible.
Well, it's interesting to me because what it does too is people that are making grassroots productions are then the responsibility of producers compared to singers is really interesting because what you're working with are a bunch of people that moved here to sing with the Lyric, but then either didn't get into the Lyric or realized that the Lyric wasn't what they wanted to do. So you're kind of dealing with like all of this displaced artistic energy.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's really interesting thinking about like the beginnings of floating, right? Where like a lot of basic, not basic, a lot of standard, I would say, rep, like the Cosi, the Mozart, but also like interesting things that need classical talent and then just able to do just this like phenomenal quantity and just this like extremely prolific amount of performances that you guys did during that year and a half. I think that you guys really tapped into something that I don't think other cities would have been able to, and I also think it seems to clearly be informing your next steps.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for us, the next steps has to come from a place that's more staffed and like, more like taken care of from me. Cause it's like, you know, for me, like, you know, I would have loved to say that I walked away with, you know, a stipend at all.
Yeah.
But most of it's volunteer. I mean, like most of it's like, you know, putting hours and hours and hours and hours into every project out of passion. But unless you get something back from the city, like, which I did, you know, I got things back from the city. They came back to me in a lot of ways, but without that support, like, it goes in a place that seems like it's hopeless or it doesn't get reaffirmed in some sort of way. And I think a lot of people are looking for affirmation of their talent.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that for people starting companies and casting you in a lead role for something, that means you're talented enough to sing that role. And then when you do it and you do it freaking amazing, it's like that extra level of validation. And then if it's recorded and you can put it on the internet, that's even an extra thing of validation. Like, you know, in all those steps back to back to back is just validating your talent and where it is now.
Yeah.
Because for me, it's like, you know, you're right. I mean, like there is like an outstanding amount of talent in Chicago, especially for classical singing.
Yeah.
Just an outstanding amount of talent. It's shocking for me because it's like I came from Miami and Cleveland. I'm like, oh, doesn't get much better than this. And then like I moved to Chicago and it's just like I'm just seeing like talents like Whitney Morrison, and like I mean, like she is just like a rock star of like energy and passion in her performance, and like it inspired me so much like directing her. just to see her work, because you get to see someone that is just so connected to text and so connected to everything, kind of finding roots in Chicago. And like, well, actually she's from Chicago, so like she had roots here, but like, you know, like everybody's kind of launching out of their own, I guess, artistic journey through the city. And I think if Floating Opera can be that for the singers of Chicago, I am happy to continue to do this work for them. I just think that if we have such powerful, strong, incredible, talented voices and performers, we got to make sure that the message is right on too. I mean, like, we could do Cozy 700 times.
Well, that's what...
But I mean, like, when it comes down to it, it's like, you know, everybody in Chicago knows Cozy.
Yeah.
And people in River Falls did not know Cozy.
Yeah. Well, that was an interesting thing.
Yeah.
In the whole concept of the tour, because you were trying to go, you know, standard rep in Chicago, although there's a ton of talent to sing it, like, there's a... I guess there's a difference between figuring out how a production can stay in the black and how it can really thrive. And I think that you probably recognized, and tell me if I'm putting words in your mouth or anything, but I feel like you probably recognized early that, like, doing Cozy at the Fine Arts Building every year, like, it's... Yeah, you'll definitely survive, and every production will probably be more and more interesting for whatever reason, but...
And you'll always sell tickets.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. And you'll break even, probably. Yeah. But then how do you go from that to, like, I don't know...
Innovating, I guess.
Yeah, I mean,
that's,
like...
That's where the incubator is so important.
Yeah,
absolutely.
For me, I like, you're right, like, it does inspire me. Like, you know, the incubator does inspire me to do new work and other work. And I mean, like, we've planned our whole season, but we're not announcing everything until we're at the end of the project, at the end of the next project. Like, that's what we're doing. But, like, it's cool because, like, my process is more established now. It's like, you know, before it was like, yeah, Cozy is something that I've, like, done research in college, and, like, I've sung all these arias, and I've directed scenes from this, and, like, I've done all these things, and, like, I understand the Italian, and I've been trained to do this, but, like... Like, I've realized that, you know, we did innovative things with that show. We staged it in The Round. We did it Super Mario Brothers, which, like, was crazy. And it made the concept made sense. But, like, that informed Giovanni, which was like, you know, can we incorporate built environment? Can we literally set something in a setting that is inexpensive because, like, the entire area is feeding the audience experience?
Site-specific.
Well... Yeah, site-specific, that's what that is, but by built environment...
Yeah.
I mean it more of, like, having them park next to the tombstones.
Right.
That was such a cool project. So, you're talking about last year's production of Don Giovanni that was in, like, a mausoleum, pretty much.
Crematorium. Yeah.
Which is creepier.
Which was active during the show. Like,
really?
They were cremating bodies during, like, the morning of the show.
Yeah.
Yes. Really?
Yeah. That business doesn't stop.
Yeah,
it just keeps going. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it was crazy because, I mean, I stage directed and did all the light design and, you know, basically tried to make it all kind of work on a budget, which we did. It was great because we got, like, we got a grant from Department of Cultural Affairs and Special Events from the City of Chicago, which is great. Helped us produce it. But, yeah, it was a lot of hours, and that place is just... I'm convinced it's haunted. I mean, like, it's just, like, really creepy being in there.
Yeah, well, those side things that you know what I'm talking about? There was the entrance that had the pews, kind of, and then you went in, and there was just the walls of people's family and stuff. Oh, no, not family, but people that had been cremated in that crematorium.
Yeah, there were all the ashes from, like... the hundreds of years of... It was built in 1914, so...
Yeah.
Like, over 100 years of cremated bodies, just chilling in there.
Yeah.
Well,
and we served popcorn right next to it, too.
Right.
It was still kind of messed up, but...
I know, I remember being there, seeing the show, and you took me over to a corner, and you showed me a hallway, and you were like, I will give you $50 to walk down that hallway. And
this
I
was
looked,
me?
Yes, yeah. And I looked down, and I was like...
Nope.
There is not a figure in this world.
And the lights were consistently off because it was like a side alley for during production. So, like, you couldn't have a light on. And so, like, if you walked down that hallway, it was, like, dead dark.
But that's what I'm saying, like, you know, with built environment, like,
yeah.
I think that, like, I'm saying that instead of site-specific because, yeah, you can set an opera in, like, a movie theater or, mm-hmm. like, something and be like, this is site-specific, but it doesn't feel the same unless everything around you in the experience makes you feel something.
Yeah.
Right.
You know? So, like, that's kind of, I mean, with quantum mechanic, like, you know, being in the kitchen and, like, everything being experiential through the whole thing. Like, you're tasting food. Like,
quantum mechanic was such a step left. Like, do you know what I mean by that? Like, I remember I heard the concept of quantum mechanic and I was like, whoa, that's, like, such a harsh, and I mean, not harsh, but I don't know. I thought that was really cool. And would you mind actually talking about the concept a little more about that?
Yeah, so I'm just going to first off credit the director for the piece. Andrew Snyder, brilliant, brilliant man. He worked with us for like months before. Me and him had coffee like, I want to say 4 months before the show and just started talking about projects. It's funny because like I ran into his husband on the street, like literally ran into him.
Yeah.
When I needed a pianist for our tour. And he's just like this amazing pianist that's played Lincoln Center and like right. an incredible coach. Like Paul Hamilton's like the best. But anyways, Andrew does a lot of, you know, event building. He's a creative director. So, yeah. But he's also a stage director. So we worked together to kind of try to build a short, concise opera out of this piece, Quantum Mechanic, which is written by John Bellata, and make it something site-specific and make it something within the world of what we're trying to create with floating opera. Yeah. So it started off as like, oh yeah, we can do this opera about quantum physics and make it kind of edgy in a place, and then tie down the themes of the piece. So we found out that it's about food because it's in a kitchen. We found out that it's about quantum physics. And we also found out that it's like time specific. It's like 1950s, but kind of futuristic, right?
Yeah.
So through like connections through Andrew and through connections that I pulled in through, we kind of brought this huge world together between food, between science and like live performance. So we had John Bellata write an original chamber orchestra arrangement of his piece for us in the space, and we worked with 42nd Parallel on that. We also talked to Fusion Dining Chef Al mm-hmm. About all this awesome stuff, and he created a menu based on the voices of our singers.
Yeah,
which was phenomenal. It was crazy. Like he talked to each singer, he heard them sing, figured out their personality, and made a menu off of their sound.
Mm.
So, and then Andrew, Sam and I built like an experience of like educating you about quantum physics in the space. So when you walked into the space, you literally tasted food that was related to the sound you would hear
mm-hmm.
in a soundscape in a kitchen while experiencing educational content about the Schrodingers, which is like thinking about it like in a way that like it, unless you were there, unless you experienced it yourself, I don't think you could really figure out what it was, but everybody that went was blown away by it. I mean, like mm-hmm. it was an expensive ticket, so it kind of deterred a bunch of people, but you got fed, entertained, original orchestration, like all these things. The value was huge.
Yeah.
And I think that was a really good learning experience for me because it taught me that, like, you know, who's your market?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to go to see this? And who wants to go see it in the future? I mean, like, that show, we can prepackage and sell off now. Like that 20-minute opera, we could do anywhere.
Yeah.
Because we've built it, and it's an experience that is successful, and it's something that, like, it was basically, I like to think of it as almost a trial run of, like, what we potentially could make happen in the future.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, that model of, like, pretty much, like, a built-in evening is kind of becoming a trend. Like, you guys were both in a production of La Boheme last year.
Yeah.
That it was like a $40 ticket or something like that.
I think so. Yeah, I know the one that the restaging of it is
$50. Yeah.
So a more expensive ticket, but with that you see a quality production of Boheme and you're also fed.
Yeah.
Which I think is
it included booze too.
Really?
I don't know.
We had Jello shot like cocktail cool. things that were like awesome. Yeah.
Well, and if you think about you know, your average night out to the opera. Like, yeah, you're going to go out to eat. You're going to grab a drink afterward. Like, I think it's really smart and, like, forward thinking of the opera community to be like, well, let's just shove it all into, mm-hmm. you know, 1 2-hour thing. Like, yeah, why not?
Well, what do you think? Because you have more experience on both ends as a performer and as a producer. Did it seem like that worked out from a production angle?
The Bohème?
Well, Noah, for the concept of pairing dinner and performance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. I think that's always been a thing in opera. I mean, like, you know, like, that's always been the thing. It's like, you know, even, like, you know, for Wagner operas, like, you know, like, people would eat in between each act and, like, right, all these different operas. Like, it was, like, a big thing, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, even the CSO is, like, is big on promoting that restaurant they have, Tesori,
mm-hmm. yeah,
in-house.
It's all experience.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to, I guess that's my big point. It's like, you know, the experience of going to the opera, people think, is like dressing up really fancy and like going to see high art and like all these things, but it's an experience that's like calculated and figured out. And
right.
Like, it's a formula, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, and what these smaller companies, like what you guys are doing, is you are taking that like kind of highbrow, like dressing up, going out to a fancy dinner, seeing like, you know, the CSO or, you know, an opera at Bayreuth, you know.
Yeah.
And you're taking it and you're putting it in a coffee shop or you're putting it in an industrial kitchen in a more accessible and palatable place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And making it a more, like, relatable experience, but still echoing that tradition.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's where we're at with War and Peace, too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, we're doing it at Chicago Temple,
mm-hmm.
across from City Hall.
Yeah.
Like, on Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like,
yeah,
that's very calculated, mm-hmm. but you know, it's meant to be experiential because everything you're going to experience in that show is related towards America, mm-hmm. veterans, the wars we fought and the protests we continue to have.
Mm-hmm. And this is the next floating yeah. production.
And right? That's the next one that's coming yes. up in May. So yeah, I mean, It's experience. It's you know, it's you being able to walk away different than when you walked in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, like, you know, you can't go to the shows these days and just feel nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I mean, some people do. Some people go to concerts and just like, that was nice. You know, yeah. I'm gonna go home and watch Netflix. You know. Yeah.
Like, I have a question that I want to just a past question that has to do with current events before because I do want to get into War and Peace, but I want to ask you, as a grant recipient, I know that, I don't know how much you know about, like, the National Endowment for the Arts, but that is a recent thing mm-hmm. that happened right now, and I'm curious if you'd be willing to, like, talk a little bit on that, at least your perspective of being a grant recipient, and although I will say that, like, obviously Floating is one of the companies that has managed to bring in a lot of income from ticket revenue, are there things that grants really have a, like, that companies really find a need for grants?
Well, yeah, companies that need grants are like After School Matters. Like, mm-hmm. you know, like, grants are meant for, like, people that really do services, like, you know, but I think the NEA has done important work in validating institutions.
Yeah.
And I think that without that validation, it becomes a little bit like, you know, the Wild West a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and the NEA and the NEH have been supporting, you know, a lot of organizations like, you know, they've been supporting, like, theater companies trying to do education programs. Mm-hmm. They've been doing a lot of, like, work in different cities related to teens and, like, you know, all those things.
Yeah.
In, like, a charitable kind of nonprofit sense.
Right.
And a lot of
the grants are, like, writers at this point in the time. I've read somewhere, and this could be totally wrong, but that it was like the thing that's interesting about the NEA is I don't think, like, obviously I don't think grassroots opera companies are gonna necessarily feel the effects of it immediately, but a lot of the things that we'd perceive as stable artistic careers really take a blow from that.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on your budget and how much impact you have. I think, for me, I know I'm not happy about the NEA,
right.
like, you know, potentially, like, not being a thing anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that is a point of validation. It's to encourage big donors to donate to this organization.
Sure.
So I'm for people, you know, not pointing at this direction, maybe they'll point at Floating Opera, you know,
right.
You know, who knows? Like, it's not like my most experienced field, but I think overall from the conversations I've had, the NEA supports nonprofits and it supports major institutions.
Yeah.
And kind of gives that validation. And if that validation's gone, I really hope that like there are people that are credible that are donating to organizations that can make change and make great art. Because if they start donating to companies that like, you know, that aren't really doing that, like it's all gonna get lost.
Yeah. Cool. All right, thank you. So the other thing that I really want to make sure we talk about is the War and Peace concept. And you've already kind of mentioned a bit, and we were saying that it's like the next floating project. But we were talking a little bit about before that we were recording, and you were kind of saying that like it's really going to be surprising. I think you used different words for it, but it's not necessarily what you expect.
Yeah, so it's gonna be a project that's in four different acts, right? Mm-hmm. Four different, very distinct acts. And it's going to be a project following a narrative of soldiers going to war and coming back to kind of a different world and the protest that comes from that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're featuring composers and compositions that were extremely important to U.S. history and to European history. We're featuring World War I composers like Ernest Farrar, Patrick Hadley, you know, a lot of forgotten composers. Not just like doing Britain compositions or like, you know, things like that. I did a lot of research to try to find, you know, things that actually connect to the narrative, but also connect towards a historical project that like this, mm-hmm. this one is. Yeah. So it starts off Pride and Glory. It starts off in this world of celebrating war, which is like a thing that did happen. You know,
yeah.
And still does.
Still does. And it's, you know, celebrating the war, celebrating all the things that go into, you know, fighting for the country and patriotism and like call to arms. I mean, if you listen back to like what those songs sound like it's actually like the craziest music. It's like very, very fun. Like being at a carnival.
Yeah.
Like, you know, mm-hmm. yeah.
Well, no, it's amazing how art was used to like drum up support for military aggression. I mean, there, like you're saying, there are countless songs like that song, like over there, yeah, over yeah. there. Like it's, and like so much, like there's this like pro-military art around that mm-hmm. era is fascinating.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
there's also like, you know, stories that people don't know. Even now, I mean, it's, you know, historians are doing a great job of documenting everything. It's amazing how much content there is about World War I composers and famous compositions. It's great that I could like go on the internet and I could find out about all these things. But it's really, really also cool, like making your own timelines for like Debussy, right? The fact that he died right at the end of the World War One. And that his last composition was all about children that don't have homes. And this horrible, like very heart-wrenching piece. Mm-hmm. And it's for baritone. It's like, you know, that's like how I know about it. But like, yeah. you know, yeah. but it's like, it's got these qualities to it that are extremely tragic. And, you know, there are so many composers that did that. Like Poulenc, like was another one of those. Like Lassus, like all kind of reacted to that in Europe post-World War I. Also you've got a lot of composers in Great Britain that recognized that these famous talents had been disposed of through war, and like Vaughan Williams and like, you know, Finzi and all these other composers tried to find these works and like reimagine them or create them anew, like
resurrect them.
Yeah. And I think, it's funny because, like, even with all those efforts they put in, we still don't know their names.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tragic thing. It's like, you know, when I look around and I'm like, I'm listening to this music and it's beautiful. And like, you know, I'm listening to a lot of these great composers and it's great. And I have to go contact the Royal Academy of Music to find their music because it doesn't exist in the United States besides like one collector in Utah. It's like, you know, can you believe that? Like,
Well, it's amazing to me how far autographs can travel. I think about that because that's kind of my day job right now, is doing that, working with Philip Gossett, and a lot of times we're like go through Rossini manuscripts and they're like in like California and like Boston and stuff, and it's just like Italian composers and the same kind of thing there where like I don't know.
Like, how did this original manuscript end up in in Los Angeles or Boston when it's when it was written in Padua or whatever.
I don't know. Anyway, sorry, I totally just went off on him.
Well, the second, so I mean, we do feature all these like things to do with like World War One and all those things, but we also have a significant part of the program to deal with protest songs.
Yeah.
So, you know, the biggest thing for me is like, you know, there were so many. There were so many great protest songs. And the big commentary that's happening right now is like a lot of people go to protests and they try to protest, but there's no melody attached to the, any protest songs. And it's not catching on. People don't know the protest songs from Vietnam, or they don't know the protest songs from before. So like our generation's having a lot of trouble creating these new protests because we don't have that common language through a song, through something like that. So one of the things that we're going to be doing in early May is we'll be doing just an all music sort of concert at Lincoln Park Presbyterian Church with them to kind of talk about the issue of protest songs.
Yeah.
I was actually really happy that I got to go to Chicago Voices' panel at Columbia all about protest music.
Cool.
A lot of experts from Old Town School of Folk Music, Columbia, like all these people like really talking about all these issues. And it's true, like, you know, we used to know how to protest. We used to really know how to do it. I don't think we really do it the same way anymore, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting on the note of just how difficult archiving is. And I think that was kind of where I was going at before is like, you know, the like with the interest of different governments maybe putting things into a corner, like maybe there were people that wrote down protest music from long ago, but like it would never see the light of day, or if it did, it's in some random place. And I think that's interesting from a producing standpoint, because working to make that happen and to pull all of these different influences from things that are potentially hidden is a really tricky game to play, I think, too.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool that you're doing that. And I also, so like, was there a lot of discussion about that in that panel that you were talking about at Columbia?
About like archiving or?
Well, even just like how does someone, I don't know, man, I guess,
I think the biggest thing that they touched about, they talked about at the panel that I took away was, you know, like writing words to a melody that everyone can sing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just a creative expression that is difficult to reproduce. Right. You know, something really easy to reproduce really fast that everybody can learn and everybody can do instead of just chanting words.
Right.
Or like doing a really fast dialogue that you can't understand. You know, because I think that one of the things that I was hearing in a lot of the protests in Chicago was there was just so many voices and so many chants, and like a lot of them weren't coming together.
Mm.
And I think that, you know, there's something to be said that like if everyone's using the same voice, like that's why everybody was protesting before, after the election. They want to come from the same perspective. But if you have so many voices saying too many different things, it becomes an unorganized message.
Isn't that interesting that that the problem that we're having with like coming together in terms of like the sounds we're producing at protests so closely reflects the issue that we're having as a political movement, you know, as far as the left.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many disparate voices and there are so many different opinions of what our next steps should be and what leadership should look like. And
well, you know, it was interesting. Sorry, I just cut you off.
How dare you? No, and like to, you know, to see that kind of disorganization coming, you know, even down to the level of like, what are we actually physically saying? Not even like message, but what are we physically saying at these protests? Mm-hmm. Like the fact that people are now recognizing like, we're not even saying the same shit.
Well, it's interesting because once you kind of like try and boil down the least common denominator message, like sometimes it isn't representative of every minority group in the group, you know?
Yeah.
That's something we were talking about.
But a lot of protest music also didn't have to do with, like, it was more of a personal reaction.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
And it's, you know, it's kind of beautiful when you look at some of the Vietnam protest songs, it's funny, like, Sam's dad, like, you know, is like an archive of knowledge on, like, so many hundreds of protest songs. So, like, you know, I'm like listening to all the ones he's suggesting, like checking all of them out. And it's great because, you know, there are real characters and real people that you can acknowledge with, like, you can, like, kind of connect with them through their story and this kind of folk tradition or this protest tradition, like, that was coming out of Vietnam protest songs. And it culminated in a way that was, like, you know, trying to make an impact into the world. And I think that relates to what Debussy also was doing with his last composition. It was a protest to war.
Yeah.
You know?
Of, like, look what it's created.
He did the same thing in 1918. You know? It's crazy. Like, it was, like, this, like, it was the last thing he wrote. He just, like, expelled this song into the world with this text that was, like, tragic.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, a lot of people have written many tragic protest songs too, just to spread the word about what the impact of all these things are. And, like, with me, it's like, for messages in this piece, I mean, like, dealing with veterans, like PTSD was like is a huge problem post-war. Yeah. And have we really taken care of veterans after they came back from the war? Are we still doing that now? I don't know. Are they left alone in the world? And what's taking care of them? Is it, like, our technology?
Yeah.
Like, is that what we're leaving them to take care of them? Like, it's like, are we just leaving them to Siri to, like, you know,
yeah.
take care of them? Like,
jeez.
And that's kind of crazy. Like, you come back from war and what do you have? You have a computer to console you.
You have a computer and horrible memories.
Right.
Yeah.
There's actually an organization in Milwaukee that a friend of mine, her parents have started it. It's this theater group called Feast of Crispian. And what they do is they have a grant from they work with the VA, and I think that they're, like, funded by the VA, where they take veterans with PTSD and they do classical theater workshops with them, and they do derived works, they do stagings, they, like, put on Shakespeare with veteran only actors.
That's awesome.
And they started out with, like, you know, Shakespeare's works that came out of, that were inspired by war, so, like, you know, the Henrys and the, you know, all of those, and to see the impact that it has on these veterans is incredible. So I think that there is a place in the arts for these veterans, and to see that movement starting is really encouraging.
Yeah. And seeing people that were originally, that are were 3 or 4 years ago making things that were just the things they knew how to do from school.
Yeah.
Like, going and trying to take a step outside of that, like, classical music bubble is really powerful.
But here's the thing, like, you know, the whole point of this composite opera is, like, is essentially to engage people in these conversations. Like, yeah. I'm so happy that we just got on this tangent about veterans right now, because it's like, you know, it's something that I hope that the piece will also do.
Well, okay, so we have a couple minutes left. The last thing that we always do with our guests, and this is something we're really big on, is a minute promotion, just rambling of, like, whatever you have upcoming, whatever you want to talk about, just, like, a really strong plug.
Where we can find you, for additional resources,
Cool.
Yeah.
You could find us on the interwebs, through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're going to be also doing, you know, a lot of e-blasts and promotions for the next couple months leading up to the production. You'll see a lot of us on social media. Our website is www.thefloatingoperacompany.com.
The Floating Opera Company?
Thefloatingoperacompany.com. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Facebook, and, right? Yeah, was it Facebook?
We have Facebook, we have Twitter, great. We have all that. And we already have a ticket site up for War and Peace.
Cool.
One of the cool things, though, is one of the things we're doing for this show is, if you can't attend and you'd like to have someone from the VA go to the show for you, you can donate a ticket to a veteran. So,
that's cool. And how do people do that?
They'll do it through a ticket request form that we'll have with a promo code.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome.
So, yeah. So it's going to be attached to that. And we're really trying to also feature veteran art in our lobby. So if you want to purchase some VA artwork. We're working on to have that displayed so you can buy that in the lobby. Right. And it'll go back to the artist that created it, which is kind of awesome. We're just trying to connect people to the institutions that are in Chicago to support our veterans for this. And you'll the piece by itself, I mean, we've talked a lot about it today, but I mean, the piece by itself, everyone's going to come back with an impression from it. It's not going to be offensive towards veterans at all.
Mm-hmm.
We're being very sensitive towards like whatever they experienced with our programming. So we encourage everybody to come. I really hope that people stay in town for Memorial Day, but if they're not, if they're back by Monday night before work starts, it's at 7:30 on Monday night at Memorial Day weekend.
Nice.
It's also that Sunday as well at 2:30, and another performance at Lincoln Park Presbyterian Church on the 27th at 7:30.
Cool.
Yeah.
Great.
Awesome. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson.
And I continue to be Maureen Smith.
If you want to check out some of our articles, old and new, you can head over to scopymag.com. We've got a few new contributions that we're kind of toying around with to see what works. If you are a journalist and want to send stuff in, you can to scopymag@gmail.com. We're looking for AP-style story pitches. We'll need a resume and a story pitch, obviously. You can also check us out on our Facebook page, Scopy Magazine. You can check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Scopy Mag.
And as always, I would like to urge the importance of donations. We run on a zero budget, and we would love to expand our reach. We are hoping to expand our literary presence, you know, through Scopy Magazine. We would also love to start an initiative called Scopy Studio, where we put up, you know, low budget, you know, intimate performances of, you know, chamber music, poetry, folk music, whatever you want to present, we want to promote.
Yeah.
But we can't do that without your help. You can go to scopymag.com, go to the About section. You can do a one-time donation or become a subscriber. If you become a subscriber, we'll give you a shout out on the show. If you do a one-time donation, we will send you a handwritten thank you note. So give a little, give a lot. And if you can't give, then listen, participate, and share.
Thanks so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yep.